This is a true story.
The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in Wisconsin and New York in 2017.
At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed.
Out of respect for the dead, the rest has been told exactly as it occurred.
Welcome to the Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the George to my Ringo and the Marco to my Bingo, it's Dan.
Hey, Dan. Good morning, Scott. Good morning.
Yes, I feel like we're both having bleary-eyed mornings today. I don't know how much sleep you got, but I know I got very little.
Yeah, I got 7 hours or so. I stayed up while finishing the second season of Six Feet Under, and then fell asleep maybe 15 minutes later.
Oops, second season. Good one.
Yeah, definitely not too many happy characters at the end of the second season of that show, I'll tell you.
Oh, wait till... it's gonna seem like a happy romper room style season before you get to the next couple. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I made it through season one of Leftovers. I guess I could handle more bleak, depressing, but somewhat more realistic shit going down.
There you go. But luckily, we are here to talk about two shows this week that I don't think were much in the way of bleak or depressing. We're only going to be chatting about Better Call Saul and Fargo this week. Mainly because, number one, they're both the penultimate episodes of that show, so we really want to devote a little bit of time and thought to them. And number two, you haven't had time to watch the latest episode of Twin Peaks, which is funny, since you have more ready access to it than I do. But that's fine. I think what we're going to end up doing is maybe pushing Twin Peaks aside for a week or two, and if we decide to, after Fargo and Better Call Saul are done, we just do a little bit of a Twin Peaks podcast from time to time or whatever. But I guess we'll figure that out.
Yep.
So let's not waste any more time, and let's get right to our first show of the week, which would be Better Call Saul. Now, the latest episode of Better Call Saul was titled Fall. It was written by Gordon Smith, the writer of some of the best Better Call Saul episodes, such as 5-0 and Chicanery. And it was directed by, I always love this name, Minky Spyro, who is actually probably best known for directing many episodes of Downton Abbey, of all shows. Okay, this was another one of those episodes. I appreciate the fact that they kind of divvied up the screen time nicely and storylines between several characters. So I'm feeling like maybe we can start with one McGill this week and end with the other. So I was thinking we could start with Chuck. That was pretty much something to start with, I think.
Yeah, that situation we've been, waiting for to escalate for a couple weeks now, and it definitely has escalated.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you've got this character, you got this guy. He's so determined now to prove, not to prove, that his illness just isn't all in his head, because it seems like he's actually accepted that, at least to whatever extent that he can. But now he needs to prove that he can conquer it. And he's not just, because he's kind of almost been like an invalid for the last several years, I think, on the show, in his life, rather.
I can totally respect what he's trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, that whole scene when the show that he puts on for Howard, by turning on, he has all the lights on, especially the fact he's holding that electric mixer. When you think about the pain that he's putting himself through to do that, because it doesn't matter if he rationally knows that the illness isn't real, because the pain for him is real, That's something. That's the fact he puts himself through that just to make a point. I'm not sure if I want to say that it's admirable, but it's something, you know?
Yeah, it feels like one of those like symbolic things that he's definitely suffering for. But I thought it was interesting. Looked like a nice hand mixer too. Pretty nice.
Yeah, of course. But I think the thing that was really compelling about the storyline in the episode is that it ends up becoming this whole Chuck versus Howard confrontation, which we haven't gotten yet, but I guess it's been a slow build to this eventually. It's the more I think about it, it's almost a little hard to pick sides on that one. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like the stuff we'll go over with Jimmy later against like the others, the various attorneys working on the Sandpiper case, where it's just like, you know, there isn't necessarily any super good guys here, but you can kind of see how anybody on both sides of it can justify it. So yeah, it's when there, I don't know if there's a very many victims in this situation.
Right. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people. They're instinctively going to go against Chuck because of obviously what he's done to Jimmy over time. But on the other hand, it's kind of hard not to see his point of view here. However, I think the fact, it comes down to this. What he's proposing doing, which is because once Howard, not just suggests, but really says he needs to step down, either go on to be just, a partner in name only, emeritus, blah, 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 whatever you call it. And Chuck is more about he'll sue them, and he'll force them to buy him out, and they can't afford to do that. So what he's proposing essentially is going to tear the firm apart because they can't afford to do it. And when you take that to its logical consequences, he's putting a lot of different people's jobs, careers, and thus their lives at risk there. That's the only way I think it becomes a little bit easier to side against Chuck, because some of this is coming down to an issue of pride. Once again, both brothers suffer from that, I guess. But Chuck's is just a bit more oversized, so he ends up coming off a lot more arrogant than Jimmy ever does. But then you can flip it around, and then you can see Chuck's point of view, and it's like, this he helped build this thing, and now they're trying to oust him, and they kind of have exploited the fact of his name and his illness. It's tough. I mean, and the way Howard comes off in this episode, especially with Jimmy later on, it doesn't make you want to root for Howard that much either, even though he does get a couple good lines in this episode. But
it is a law firm, and even though Howard's pretty intelligent and relatively smooth, he's more the golfer than the lawyer, so I can see why Chuck would be like, I've been holding your ass up for years, and now, you can't, do anything but, patronize me for a couple years and then kick me to the curb the second something goes to shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Speaking of things tied to the law firms and, what they've been doing for the last few years and building themselves up or down, I'd like to switch over to Kim now, because she certainly had a sizable portion of this episode and went in a direction that I think maybe we saw coming during an actual scene, but I don't know if we saw coming early. I certainly don't think we saw coming earlier in the episode.
Yeah.
I mean, that earlier mishap with her car when she's out in the oil fields, I suppose that could be seen as a form of foreshadowing, but in a weird way. But it's the fact, from the looks of it, it looks like she literally drives herself off the road because she's taken on so much. She's burning the candle at both ends, so to speak. I was trying to figure something out. Her reasoning to do this job, to take on this new client, rather than the original idea, which was to pass it on to another firm, someone who actually has the quote-unquote bandwidth to deal with it. Is this something that's been fueled, by what's happened with Jimmy? So she feels the need to do more business despite Jimmy's refusal for her to cover his half? Or is it, do you think it's about that? Or do you think it's more that she just always had this need to prove herself due to what happened to her at HHM and such? Because there's always that element with her as well. Or maybe it's a little bit of both. I'm not sure.
Yeah, or maybe she just like wants to have like a, you know, a degree of separation between her and Jimmy, where like, well, you know, technically if Jimmy, you know, helped her out with this Mesa Verde account and that dude like, you know, set her up with this, you know, it's still, you know, kind of tied to Jimmy, but in a way like, you know, it's only because of her own merit that she has this account, you know, the leader of Mesa Verde recognizes her abilities and then is willing to, you know, recommend her to somebody else. So maybe she just wants to, you know, go to something that like makes her just feel like, you know, she doesn't owe anybody for anything. She just, you know, earned it.
Right, it's and that makes sense. It's also another degree of separation from how she got Mesa Verde, so that makes some sense. I
Yeah, because
did,
that never sat well with her.
right. I also did like that they didn't do the what's become almost that cliched sudden T-boning of the car, where you see it like coming right at you, kind of like in the frame. But they did it in a very different style. It's like that sudden jump cut.
Oh yeah.
Because I like that it implied that she drifted in, you know, or maybe it's almost like she fell asleep at the wheel or something, although I don't think that's exactly what happened. But I just, it was a different way, it was a different way to do it, so it made it jarring in a way that I hadn't seen before.
And I really wasn't expecting something like that to happen either. I mean, I didn't really know what they're gonna do, but I was more just focused on like, you know, what she was saying and what she was thinking and just imagining, you know, she'd have some kind of like, you know, maybe like a, you know, end up leaving the episode being like, you know, motivated, like I'm gonna go do this, you know, because we early in the episode we saw her, you know, in a, you know, Breaking Bad-esque, almost getting stuck in the desert situation, and then like, you know, finding a way to push herself out. Which is kind of nice. So I was, you know, kind of like hoping we'd see something like that. And but the yeah, the, that was pretty jarring. You know, we've seen some really odd editing this year on you know, stuff like Twin Peaks and this, where just they just do stuff in a way where it's not really what we're used to. So that was definitely definitely something I didn't see coming at all. And it's something that's like happened to me before once too, where like that I was driving across Interstate 90 coming back from South Dakota once, and like, you know, I wasn't particularly tired, just kind of sitting there, you know, zoning on the fucking road, and then all of a sudden I'm in the median, and unfortunately it was an area where like, well, you know, Nebraska, South Dakota, all those states are really freaking flat, so as long as you go off the road in between the two sections of interstate, you're, you know, for the most part fine. So I just ended up in like some grassy stuff 6 inches below the roadway, but it was enough to really shake me. So seeing somebody else go through it and just imagining it like they're in a state that's more mountainous, it was really something.
Yeah, looked like it was kind of very a much more precarious situation than if it had just been a purely flat area. Sadly, she had a little car accident where Mike always seems to be driving or something like that, which is always like the great vast plains or something. So switching from Kim to like say the stuff that's going on with Nacho here.
Well, before we leave Kim, I enjoyed seeing Twin Peaks' own Chris Mulkey as the oil man dude.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's
Yeah,
funny.
you know we know. Yeah.
I know from so many other things. I don't readily identify him as a Twin Peaks actor, though I realize he was in the second season of Twin Peaks. Correct? Is that what it?
Right. Yeah, because he's been in a bunch of shows that we've watched. You know, just you know, one episode of Lost and a you know, and a Locke flashback. And I remember the year where we covered the or we made predictions about the three TV series endings finales, and he was on two of them, Boardwalk Empire and Justified. So, you know, he's been in, you know, plenty of shows we talk about before. But yeah, I definitely know him from Twin Peaks, and he will not be returning to this season of Twin Peaks. But it's nice to see him here.
Yeah, he's one of those actors. If you look him up on IMDb, he has like a long list of credits. Although, and at least, you know, hats off to you for remembering his name, because I certainly didn't. Okay, so where was I about to go? Oh, Nacho. I wanted to get to Nacho here. Now I'm hungry. So, Nacho, and that scene with his dad was really sad, actually, I thought. Oh, by the
Oh,
way,
yeah.
speaking of actors, who, if I'm not mis that actor who plays his father, who also, if I'm not mistaken, played a rather bad hombre, so to speak, in the little seen but much adored FX series that I was a big fan of called The Bridge. Oh, by the way, again, because I know you haven't seen it yet, he also appeared on Twin Peaks this past week. Actually, at the very tail end of the previous episode, he was the security guard dude who sees Donnie and tells him to move on. You know, sir, you can't loiter here. That's him, same actor.
Oh yeah.
So we pick up with him again at the beginning of this episode. Spoiler for Twin Peaks, sorry. Anyway, not much of one. So back to the Nacho scene. There's a sadness because apparently Nacho's been down this road before with Salamanca, much to his father's disappointment. So, but the way they're talking here, it seems like he wasn't aware of his son's current dealings with him. Cause that was the impression I got from that scene.
Yeah, they definitely showed that, like, I mean, I don't think we've really seen them discuss this kind of, like, seedy stuff before, other than, you know, we've seen Nacho talk about how he doesn't want his, like, you know, father to find out about this kind of thing. But just the way they told the scene, I mean, they gave us a fair amount of information while it still felt like an actual, like, conversation that people might really have. So it's definitely, you know, just, and yeah, you're right, you know, really good performance by the dude playing his father. Like, just the way, like, disappointment just, like, you know, just drips down his face. It was, you know, wasn't fun to watch. And, you know, great acting by Michael Mando, too.
Oh yeah, he's really doing a great job on the show this season. Then you had the other scene that was really between Hector and Fring, where Hector clearly takes the pills, but we know they're the pills that Nacho planted on him. So, but it appears in that scene that they have, I guess, what you call a placebo effect on calming him down. So, I mean, I still think that's got to be the way this all goes down, because they spent too much time building up this whole pill plot for that not to be how it goes. So, and Nacho, when he speaks to his father, talks about how this should all be over in a few weeks. So I was trying to figure out how he came up with the idea it would take a few weeks. So I was wondering, in those pills, is it a reduced amount of what it's supposed to be? Is it something that is just not the drug at all? Or something that's more slower acting? I guess, I mean, since we're never told, I guess we can't be truly sure. But I was trying to figure that out, because I assumed he's replacing it with something that was nothing, that wasn't any drug at all. But I don't know. I mean, I thought it was just like, you know, almost like sugar pills or something.
I suppose there's always a possibility that instead of just having him be sugar pills or whatever, maybe he put in something like a blood thickener. Because, you know, if Tio does end up having a stroke at some point, you know, thickening his blood probably would not. Wouldn't do him any favors.
Right, I just assume it's not a form of a drug like that, because then the guy he paid to get the empty capsules, he would have needed to get that drug as well. So he would have, you know, had him get that drug as well. And that's why I don't think it's an actual pharmaceutical that he put into those. But of course, we don't know that. I don't know that for an absolute fact. It seems like if he would have needed that, he would have gotten that at the same time. I don't know if he went down to the pharmacy and picked up a few. But who knows? He might have, you know, picked up some. Well, those are all blood thinners. He wouldn't pick up some aspirin. I guess we'll see. But I just assumed it would be some form of a quote-unquote sugar pill. So it would also be something that wouldn't be easily traced in his system, where someone would, if there was ever like an autopsy done and someone would know that he was actually murdered or something like that. I think there's something really important that we learned in this scene, though, I think, because based on how what Hector does, his reaction to what he's told, which is essentially that pretty much all the drug shipping is going to go through Fring now, kind of leaving Hector out in the cold. He just, you know, has to go along with it. When he basically says, you know, fuck everyone, including Don Eladio, I'm starting to see why he might end up in that crappy little house with Tuco that we saw back in season 2 of Breaking Bad. Why someone who was so high up on the in the hierarchy is left to fucking languish in a wheelchair in some shitty little house. If he's got an attitude like that, you know I've had to get back to the Don.
Oh yeah, you got Gus, the cool professional businessman, and then you've got, you know, on the other side, a fucking child throwing a tantrum. After a while, that kind of person can only seem to be so valuable. So yeah, well, I can see how that definitely a piece of that puzzle seems to have been presented.
Yeah, that's the way I'm looking at it. So going along that train of characters and storylines, we got a nice little scene that I wasn't actually expecting, but it was fun. Mike and Lydia. Which really made me want to go back to the early in the fifth season of season five. Did I just say the fifth season of season five? Wow. The fifth season of Breaking Bad. Makes me really want to rewatch some of those moments, especially when he's looks like he's about to kill her and whatever.
Yeah, I
That
think maybe I'll rewatch that show in maybe mid to late July, just because I don't like to watch that kind of stuff, unless I'm going to be like heading on a trip to the Southwest anytime soon, which I'll be doing in mid-August. So, or else I get depressed and be like, oh, I want to be in the desert, wah, fuck my life, fuck this like nice moderate temperature I have here and like moisture. So, I'm looking forward to doing it again too.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe after I've dug my way out of all the Netflix shows I need to catch up on over the next month or so, maybe I might push Breaking Bad to a rewatch because I haven't rewatched it since it ended. I've never seen even rewatched the last season more than the one time I saw it,
Yeah, same here.
which when I look back on that, considering how much I watched the previous seasons and how much I enjoyed the final season, it's almost shocking that I've done that. But they're sitting in that other room somewhere. I think one DVD pack is still in its shrink wrap for all I know. But I like that line that she has, her reaction to him when you said you think he's just a drug dealer. So what's interesting about that is how we're going to watch, I think, how Mike's view of Gus Fring is going to continue to evolve. Because, like, right now, that's his perception of him. Although he's a much more courteous, a dignified or polite version of what Hector Salamanca actually is, he still views him in that same way, so to speak, at this point in time. But I think it's pretty clear by the time we get to Breaking Bad that he's definitely like one of Gus's men, like lock, stock, and barrel at that point, is the impression I had. So
Right.
it's just interesting to see how this relationship, I don't want to call it a friendship exactly, but relationship will evolve and how much we'll actually get to see it evolve on the show. But Mike is just fun to watch, so it's always that. Excuse me. All right, so let's get to Jimmy. And kind of going with what you were saying before, about what Jimmy does and kind of oof, it's a tough one. It's a tough one with Jimmy here. I think they're continuing to push, more and more episode to episode, giving us these scenes or moments with Jimmy that just make him maybe just a little less likable from here and there, or making his actions a little harder to defend or stomach. I mean, even if they're done in a somewhat amusing way, because there's always going to be that comic tendency that they do with that character that Bob Odenkirk does as well. But when you strip that away, there's a certain cruelty to it. Like what he did to Chuck at the insurance thing. I mean, on one hand, oh, it's there's something kind of funny about him putting on the boo-hoo act, but at a certain point, it becomes a bit insidious, especially when he walks out and has that little, nasty little smile on his face. What he does to that old lady, man. Oof.
Yeah, I mean, it started out, I was just like, oh, the sandpiper case, I forgot about this. I mean, didn't really forget about this, but I wasn't, it's been a while, and I wasn't really expecting him to go back to that, and then it's like, huh, it's nice to see them, following up on this, and then I remember Jimmy had money coming from him, which I'd forgot about over the last few episodes as he's struggled to make some scratch, so, I just kind of watched, and I was, it's interesting to see the way he, he's just kind of like trying to like hold on to like kind of doing the right thing. I mean, he's still like, trying to, talk her into doing something to so he can benefit from it. But yeah, watching him turn from like manipulative to like Machiavellian by the end of the episode, it's just like, oh, you bastard.
Yeah, I mean, we'll certainly want to give him credit that he doesn't start out. This isn't his plan from the get-go. He does end up being. He does, in his mind at least, think he's gotten boxed into a corner. This is what he has to do. Although on the other hand, he could find other ways or other means to make money in the meantime. But I think when he's confronted with that number that he would be entitled to. What is like 1,160,000 or some number like that. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because minutes earlier, he has his own scene with Howard, and Howard really crushes him, you know, and really kind of in a way that I don't think I've even seen Howard sweep him aside in a way that I don't think he has in the previous couple seasons of the show. Just and you know, you can see that Jimmy's like, you know, doesn't know what to do, or maybe he does, but it's what he didn't want to do. And then the whole con, or whatever you want to call it, with all the little old ladies to turn them against Irene, it's just, it was a little hard to watch because it was just so, it was so mean. And you felt so bad for this poor woman who has no idea what's happening and why her friends are abandoning her. And that's kind of the cruelty of it, because you end up doing putting this plan into motion, which is going to isolate this person, but it's isolating her from her friends. And you know, that's mean if you do it to anybody, but think about this person's life. I mean, that's probably her life really from day to day is, you know, hanging out with this little community, this little group of ladies, and they do their things together, and otherwise she's totally alone. They never mention whether she has family. And if she does, they probably don't come to visit her more than, like, you know, the occasional once a week thing or something.
I'd be interested to go back and watch some of the earlier seasons, bingo scenes where, like, you know, Jimmy's not being a douche and, you know, yeah, he's trying to drum up business and being, you know, Mr. Fake Madlock, but it's actually kind of like, you know, funny and sparkle. And you just watch this scene, it's just like everything he says is just like, just so hollow, and everything is so dark, and it's just, I mean, I bet you if you watch those two scenes back to back, it'd be like, you know, this completely different thing, you know, like going from a comedy to not a horror film, but, you know, definitely a huge tonal shift.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things where we say, okay, they're doing more transitioning him to become Saul Goodman. Although there's even part of me that wonders, would Saul Goodman do this? I guess he would. I mean, he's a guy who suggests murder from time to time, so making an old lady feel really bad maybe wouldn't be beyond Saul Goodman. It just feels mean, you know, kind of like the thing with Chuck.
Yeah.
But at least with Chuck, we said one could say, yeah, but maybe Chuck in some way deserves this because of what a bastard he's been. This little old lady didn't deserve it, and we don't know if her making the decision that he wants her to make is going. It's really going to restore her friendship with those ladies. I assume it would, but wow, just mean. But
yeah,
but it made for a great episode. I mean, I really love this episode from top to bottom. I think it's one of the better ones, and I genuinely, it's not just that I can't wait to see the finale for this show. I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. I don't know which things are going to get wrapped up or give us cliffhangers or whatnot. I mean, we've semi-joked that we keep thinking that, you know, Chuck/Fire is going to happen, and the fact that the episode's titled Lantern seems to almost be emphasizing that. But for all I know, they could have a flashback where Jimmy's reading an issue of Green Lantern. Who the heck knows? You know? I wouldn't put it past him just to screw with us that way or something like that. And the same thing,
yeah.
Will they get to the point where Hector has the big health seizure moment, whatever, or not?
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think the show's been picked up yet as of a couple days before the finale, and you know, it seems like a pretty sure thing that they'll you know, if they're going to keep giving Halt and Catch Fire more seasons, it's a pretty safe bet they'll do more Saul. But I'm curious to see if this episode will kind of had the feel where, like, if they didn't do any more, you know, is enough resolved where it'd be okay, like we've seen in certain series are able to do that. So I'm interested to see how they do this next episode.
Yeah, I will be unbelievably angry if somehow, some way, they didn't pick it up. I can't imagine that happening, but it is strange that they've dragged their feet at this point. Speaking of Halt and Catch Fire, they just added someone to the cast. The final season, which seems weird because I think that final season is going to start in the next couple months. Like, I haven't seen, but probably this summer. One of the actresses from Veep is going to be on Halt and Catch Fire, so I'm kind of excited about that.
And, sweet. And a good fit for the show, would you say?
it'll be an interesting fit. Anna Klumsky, who was really great on Veep.
I know. Yeah.
Actually, everyone was on Veep. Every single actor on Veep is great on Veep. So anyone from that show would be good on any show.
Nice.
Anywho, so I think we can move on from the land of BCS. Yeah, I said it that way on purpose. And let's get ready for Fargo. Now, the latest episode was titled Aporia. It was written by, of course, Noah Hawley and Bob DeLaurentiis, who, as I've noted in the past, has written a few previous Fargo episodes, such as Lop Lop. And it was directed by Keith Gordon. Also, as stated before, he's the former actor who's directed episodes of this series, as well as The Leftovers, Better Call Saul, actually all this season, and even things from, like, Dexter, Rectify, Homeland, and so on. Hey, I love this episode. What was your feeling on the episode by the time it was over?
Yeah, they've definitely reached the point where it's actually like I'm looking forward to seeing the show because I expect it to be good instead of just like, oh, I hope it's good this week. So it's they're firing on all cylinders here in the back nine of the season.
Yeah, I mean we were hoping / speculating a few weeks ago when the show felt like it was had turned a corner finally. That, okay, maybe if they can maintain or keep rising in the quality from week to week, it might redeem the season, so to speak. I think this episode redeemed the season. It's still not, unless the finale is amazeballs to the extreme, I'm still going to prefer seasons 1 and 2 easily. But at least now, the way I feel about this season, I don't feel like I wasted my time anymore. I don't feel like I was cheated anymore. There were so many good things about this episode and so many storylines and characters that it did so much to improve that I felt so much better about the show and about our taking the time to even podcast about it, quite frankly, watching this
episode. With this season of Fargo, it's kind of been like let's say you find a recipe for something that looks like really good on Facebook, like a cooking thing, and then you're making it right, and like while you're like in the preparation process, it just doesn't look right and it just isn't turning out. But like now it's at the point where like, oh, like, you know, all the ingredients like were there and like, yeah, this does look like it's gonna be kinda good, and like now we're enjoying it. And it's delicious.
Yeah. I mean, right off the bat, because I think a lot of this episode, I would even, although there's little interesting bits and cool parts aside, which I'm sure we might chat about here or there if we have time. But for me, I felt it really came down to really three scenes, just one person talking to another person scenes. The first one for me clearly is going to be the Emmett and Gloria scene that pretty much starts off the episode after another Stussy gets murdered. Lord. It's Emmett's best scene of the series. Easily. And because it's the first scene with that character that made me care about the character, like genuinely care about the character. He tells a story. I think it's McGregor, and at least as the character Emmett, I think it's his best work on the series so far. The whole...
His best work since The Phantom Menace, probably.
I certainly hope for Mr. McGregor's career he's done something decent in the 20 years between. I'm sure he has it. Nothing's occurring to him right at the very moment. But first, the revelation that it turns out that Ray was right all along, and then we actually get the story of how his brother screwed him over, and it's told in such a way that it's a great story. It doesn't matter that this is it's a huge pile of exposition because it's told in a meaningful way. It's really done well about how he took advantage of his brother because they were both young, but his brother's a little younger. And I love that it turned out to be about, you know, he was a chubby kid who couldn't even get laid, so he dangled the car in front of him and got him to think that it was his idea to trade the stamps for the car. And I mean, the whole thing, when he says he's been killing him for 30 years or so, some line like that, and finally it happened. That whole scene, I mean, I was moved by it. I was surprised by it. I loved, and even that's the kind of scene where you even want to give Carrie Coon credit, because just listening, the way she's taking it all in is just done very well. And it's one of those things where at the end of it, I mean, it's clear that it was a horrible accident, even though Emmett believes himself to be a murderer. And, you know, whether they say it's it, whether they accept the story that he told and make it into an involuntary manslaughter thing or pure murder, not, you know, of course, by the end of the episode, it doesn't matter. That becomes entirely moot. But yeah, I was very impressed with that scene alone. Before we even got to the rest of the episode, I was already like, wow, this is really good stuff. I'm, you know, this is the first time I give two fucks about this character. I wish I could have cared about him 5 or 6 episodes ago, but it really worked for me very well.
But yeah, it was really nicely done, and I enjoyed just, you know, yeah, everything about it. Just the way where, like, you know, you can kind of, like, you can't totally blame, you know, Emmett for everything he did when he was a child, because, you know, I mean, he's just like, yeah, you know, I, you know, what kind of 17-year-old wants the stamps or whatever, but, you know, it didn't seem like he was going out of his way back then to totally screw him over either, even though he's totally blaming himself, like, you know, pretty much like, you know, he feels like he's the person Ray thinks he is now. But I liked how everything they said up about this. And yeah, Carrie Coon, I mean, you know, damn, you know, you watch her on this show, and we've seen her on another show playing a, you know, law enforcement type person, whatever. And it's just like, you don't even think about Nora Durst when you're watching this show. It's just like, you know, just disappears into the role, makes it her own, and it's, you know, really nicely done.
Right. And the thing with Emmett in this scene, when you realize this is why he's probably been, you know, giving his brother money whenever he can over the last, you know, again, I think he says in like 30 years, because he's had this relationship built on guilt. Because he knows, because he was old enough at that age to know these stamps are worth a lot of money.
Right.
That's a much bigger deal than a car, you know. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he tricks his brother. It's like a game show kind of routine. Like, oh, will you take the blah, 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 or this shiny new car or something? You can be set up for life or a car. Oh, I'll take the car because I like the shiny new car. Oh, well. So
it was like, you know, taking the lump sum in a lottery payment, or like, you know, because you won't live long enough to do it. So young, I guess young Emmett was, you know, Jimmy-like at that time.
Yeah, he could see the forest for the trees, where, you know, Ray just was hoping to get laid, you know, because he was, you know, young. You know, I get that, so to speak. Anyway, so that's like the first big, you know, twofer scene, so to speak. The next one that really stood out for me, and I would say right now, I call it the coolest showdown of the entire season. Nikki and Vargas. The whole Nikki and Vargas stuff in this episode, I loved it. It was, I mean, we've been talking all along how, you know, outside of Seinfeld, Nikki was becoming, at least for me, and I think for you as well, one of our favorite characters on the show. The more, because she's a character who seems to have progressed and evolved and become more than what she first seemed to be, from episode to episode. Fantastic in this episode, however.
Oh, yeah, really, really on point use of the character at this time.
I mean, I love that they're still using Mr. Wrench, and that he, you know, he's pretty much joined forces with her. So it really is unifying the Fargo universe, I guess. So with the heist and everything that happens earlier in the episode, but that whole the showdown between her and Vargas in the hotel lobby was so good. It actually reminds me in a weird way, and a much better version of it. Let me tell you, of the last two baseball games I've watched over the last 2 minutes, where my team, the Yankees, have been playing the A's, who generally are like a shitty team, but the Yankees, no matter how good they are every year, always get fucked when they take West Coast trips, because it's just, maybe it just saps them, I don't know. And the last couple of nights, the games have gone back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They're winning, they're losing, they're winning, they're losing, they're winning, they're losing, you know, all the way up until the very end, or even going to extra innings the other day. And eventually, of course, my team ended up losing both games. This hotel, and I just thought of that just now, so pardon my rambling, but hopefully it made sense to some people who give a damn. I like that it seems like, oh, he's, you know, I'm one up on her, or no, she's one up on me, and back and forth. But what was great about it, this is the first, I think legitimately, this is the first time in the series that I feel Vargas loses, essentially. Because even when he thinks, every time he thinks he has the upper hand, whether it's due to having, you know, the idea that he actually had multiple people in the lobby who were similar looking to him.
Yeah, and even and it seemed that, you know, even some of them seemed to be sitting next to people who look like Nikki too.
Yeah, it was so. Very fun. I mean, that I mean, hats off to the writing on that book, because I never would have thought of it. I was like, oh, that's really brilliant. You know, he's just wearing, like, they're all wearing like these drab trench coats, so all like that similar, you know, short hair kind of thing. But it doesn't matter. Or the, and then so it looks, oh, he's got one up on her, and then he's got like Mimo up there with the rifle, and. But having Wrench get the drop on Mimo was amazing. And if there was, and of course I have to pause just for a moment. If there's been one catch in their plan, and maybe it's trying to almost make us think of Nikki and thus Mr. Wrench as better people than they really actually are. Especially when freaking Mr. Wrench, was he not a hitman back in season one? Isn't that what he and Numbers were doing? They had not one, but two clear opportunities to wipe Mimo off the map. That could have been a real grenade, as they said, but they wanted to keep the truck. But they certainly could have killed Mimo earlier on. And right then and there, when he's got his rifle trained on Nikki and that gun up against it, they could have killed Mimo there as well. They don't, so it makes them more like heroes, I guess. But I kept thinking, gosh, I hope in the finale Mimo doesn't end up killing one of them, because it's going to be like they had their opportunity to get rid of him, and they didn't. Because we know the other two main henchmen of Vargas are dead. Well, we assume the Russian's dead because of a comment he made. It sounded like the Russian's dead because he met the godlike Ray Wise or whatever. And we know they beheaded DJ Qualls in the previous episode. I kept thinking, kill him. You should really kill him right now, because he's not good.
No, that was definitely interesting, and I like seeing a deaf character get the drop on somebody that like can't hear because he's listening to his music too fucking loud.
Yes, great catch on that, because it's funny how you'd think hearing would be quite possibly their most important sense. Even more so than seeing, because, you know, hearing the slightest little movement, or, you know, if they're in the forest, a branch crack or whatever, or someone take a step on the floor. The fact that they're, one can't hear at all, and the other one's hearing is impeded by the fact he's constantly wearing the headphones. And I think we've sometimes, haven't we occasionally heard the music that he's listening to? It feels like,
yeah.
I can't remember what it is, but it's always something. But that scene between them, and Nikki is just so good in that scene. And Vargas, you know, the whole thing about adding zeros, and the whole playing a game and the way she talks. Actually, what's great about that scene also, it brings the whole bridge thing back. And why bridge played such a big part in this series earlier on, why they were titling episodes after bridge, different types of moves in bridge. Because that's what Nikki is doing, and it's interesting because they could have just easily made it about chess, because chess is about making moves in advance and knowing. So I just like that they just decided to be a bit more original. It's like, yeah, but people do chess stuff all the time. We're going to do bridge instead.
Yeah, this scene where she's talking about, like, you know, talking up how great Bridge is and, like, how, you know, great strategy and how many different permutations or whatever there is. During that scene, I realized, like, the in the first episode when they kill Scoot McNairy, like, you know, she wasn't, like, some just, like, genius there. Like, she was probably just using, like, you know, like, really good Bridge mind to, like, you know, figure out what she had to do there. And I thought that was kind of, you know, kind of sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was just a great scene, period. And I love that it didn't even matter to them if they even saw a wrench with her or not later on in the scene or not. It just it didn't matter at that point. But and the fact is that we get that little thing at the end because she knows full well they're not going to pay her off, and maybe whether they'll ever pay her off or not, it's unlikely. But apparently, one can easily assume that she's the one who sends that information to the IRS. That the IRS agent gets at the end, so
and I
love that they brought that back because that also seemed to be one of those little plot threads. They thought, oh, are they not going to ever get back to that? They're just going to say that's it and nothing else happens there. The IRS doesn't usually give up that easily about anything.
Yeah.
So
I think it's also possible that maybe Emmett himself sent that to the IRS agent before he went to confess, maybe, just as like a, you know, not so much insurance, just like a, you know, I'm going to get this out now because I'm not sure, you know, I suppose that, you know, she might have knowledge about what's going on with Vargas operations from the laptop they got. But I think it's still possible that Emmett might have set that up.
Okay, I feel it's more likely her than him because she says in that scene how much she wants to hurt him,
and suggests that as a way of doing it. You know,
yeah, that's the only way I can see that she could hurt him actually, other than, like, you know, denying him food or something like that. Those awful, I'm eating Rocky Road, sitting on the toilet. Oh, good lord! And then we get to move to the final major scene that really I thought worked so well. Gloria meeting up with Winnie in the bar at the end of the episode. I think that was probably the most, for me and probably most viewers, I'm thinking, probably the most emotional scene of the episode, of the series, that's the word I'm looking for. See, I should have taken notes for this thing. I mean, it's kind of like, it's interesting. The episode begins with Emmett telling a story. And there's something kind of tragic and heartbreaking about it, right? And the episode essentially ends with the person he was telling a story to. She's telling a story now. Also to someone, also to a woman, also who in law enforcement. Oh, by the way, they passed the Bechdel test with that scene, I guess. But what you were saying about Carrie Coon earlier in her performance, man, does it work here. And what happens after it. It's such a great scene. And I love the fact that it also brings some of the what we saw in episode 3 into it in kind of a nice organic way. Have her talk about that sci-fi pulp novel that her...
Stepfather,
we know who we're talking about. And talking about the little robot who would say, I can help, but never do. And how she thinks of herself as being like that robot and the whole thing. That was really, I thought that was really, it got me. When Winnie hugs her, I had to wipe away a tear. I'll admit it.
Yeah, that was really nice. And the way they ended this episode, I mean, we've watched lots of cop shows in our time, you more than myself, but I mean, we're so used to, and you know, I'd say even conditioned to seeing, like, a character like Gloria, where, like, everything is just going crap, like, you know, she got left for, like, another dude, and, like, you know, people are dying, and, like, she lost her job, and everybody treats her like crap, and just, like, the bad guy got the upper hand. You're used to seeing a character like this go, like, full Rambo after this point, just, like, they've lost it all, and this is, like, a complete 180 from, like, that kind of storytelling, where just, like, I mean, I suppose she could go all Rambo next episode, but it's not very likely. But now we're seeing where, like, you know, where she's, like, at her worst point, we're actually seeing, like, something good happen. And then, like, all of a sudden she can wash her hands in one of those ridiculous fucking things that never work for me when I'm traveling across the country. So I hate those things. So it's just nice to see, you know, a show that's willing to do something like that, where, like, all of a sudden, you know, you just see something good happen instead of a character just, you know, do that.
The way this episode goes, everything that happens in it, the fact that Emmett thinks he's, you know, doing the right thing and going to put it all to rest, but yet he still can't escape Vargas's clutches. I mean, he's with the police, and they're basically, due to Moe's decision. And what Moe does, by the way, although we as viewers say, can't you see it's clear that this has all been planted, everyone, at least his actions are more understandable in this episode than they have been for most of the series. Like, well, you know, if this guy has confessed and all the evidence, you know, if you're a cop, you're like, okay, that's fine, you know, whatever, we'll take it. Anyway, but the fact that Emmett is still trapped in his situation, the fact that Gloria, what you just said, everything she's gone through in her life, you know, the husband, the job, and now this, even this case and how it's gone, the fact that they still found a way to end on such a lovely, positive note by the whole thing about her feeling like she's invisible, and how, you know, the running gag of how technology doesn't seem to acknowledge or recognize her, and then what happens in the bathroom. I've never in my life ever thought I would be emotionally affected by someone being able to wash their hands in a restroom, other than being thankful if they were serving me food or something like that.
Now, since then, at work, when I'm using, a similar soap dispenser, I guess. So whenever I put my hand under that, it always takes like an extra second for it to work because it's freaking stupid. But like I think about that scene every time I do that now. It's only been a couple of days, but I imagine that's going to linger with me for a little while.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure the next time I'm in a restroom, which requires like the sensor for the water or the soap. And by the way, I was feeling much like you. I was feeling glorious pain with that because half the time I can't get those sinks or toilets to work that way either. I'm like,
I hate it.
I'm like, I hate, can I just have a faucet? Give me if you can, just a regular like spigot I could just turn here. It was a lovely way to end the episode. And I think that's probably why in many ways, this might be my favorite episode of the season. Although there were great, other episodes had some great parts to them, like the whole big, chasing them after the accident in the other episode, or the stuff with the animated stuff in the LA episode. But this, for me, felt like a great episode from top to bottom, and just gave us, you know, these great little points, you know, of these scenes you could just link everything together with. I just really love this episode a lot. And we didn't even talk about, like, say, Gloria meeting with Mrs. Goldfarb, which is another great little scene, although I just didn't think it was quite as significant as the other three.
Right.
Just seeing Mary McDonald do the whole stonewalling her and then being kind of talking down to her a little bit there, but that was fun too. Yeah. And finally, the one last thing I wanted to mention about the episode is I think it gave us one of the greatest lines of the series, and I mean all three seasons, which is saying something. Considering how much we love Noah Hawley's writing specifically. Oh, I apologize if you hear someone's doing something. There's landscaping going on in the backyard, I think.
It sounds like somebody's flying a drone inside your apartment or something.
Oh, that could be happening too. But there's a line towards the end of the episode which I thought was just, wow, spot on. It's when Vargas and Emmett are in the back of that car. And the line, and it's the only thing I actually did transcribe from the episode. And Vargas says, "The problem is not that there is evil in the world. The problem is that there is good, because otherwise, who would care?" That's just spot on, great line. And you know what? I gotta say, now that we've almost completed the season, Vargas turns out to be a great villain. A truly great, he's become a really great character to watch, where to the point where I look forward to scenes that he's in. Yes, I hear it out there. Sorry. I mean, I don't look forward to close-ups of his teeth, but other than that, he's gotten. I mean, he was always good in the show, like from the get-go, but I think in the second half of the season, he's just become a much more interesting character to watch. And maybe it's because he's, you know, we've seen some weaknesses with him, or the fact that he's not gotten the better of everybody every single moment, that Nikki's actually found some chinks in the armor. But I've really loved, and David Theulis has just been knocking it out of the park. He's, if he doesn't get a supporting actor nomination for the Emmys, I don't know who will. I mean, I'm not saying he's, I don't think he's going to win necessarily. It's probably going to be someone from Feud or something, but he definitely deserves a nomination for what he's done at this point, I think.
Oh yeah, he's great. I mean, it's interesting too, because like, you know, earlier in the season, I mean, I wouldn't say for at least a few episodes we would think of him as a big bad, and it's kind of nice because Nikki kind of points it out, like how he kind of disguised himself as middle management, and then, you know, just isn't. And but you know, it took us a little while before we could, you know, see past that like facade where, like, you know, he's pretending to be middle management, but he's really like, you know, just a weird bastard.
Yeah,
in charge. So.
Oh. We genuinely could have just spent the entire episode conversation just talking about the Nikki Varga scene, because that was one of the brilliant moments, which again shows us just how maybe we should have given Nikki a lot more credit for intelligence, because the way she's been able to figure that out, like, yeah, you, because that's, it's almost, it's hiding in plain sight, because why else would he have the nerve to like be in that scene when the cops are in Emmett's office in that earlier episode? You know, if the big crime lord wants to stay in the shadow, stay out of, he doesn't mind being it, because he just seems like this nondescript guy who seems to be able to get away without even telling people what his name is. I love Nikki, who she kept asking what the VM stands for, and he still didn't answer. We still don't know. We still don't know what those initials stand for. It'll be hysterical. It'll be hysterical.
Yeah,
I suspect we won't. Or it'll be something we find out just as he dies or something like that. If he dies, we don't know. But I'm assuming some people are going to die in the finale. I can't imagine everybody survives the show at this point.
It's been a pretty low body count for a season of Fargo. I mean, you know, as if, like, you know, characters that are, you know, named characters.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, what, we've lost, like, the Russian and, you know, I don't know.
Well, you've got
and Ray.
You've got Ray, and Sai is in a coma, so we don't know if they're going to... I mean, we like to think that they'll bring him out of it, but we don't know that for a fact. I assume they're going to... Sai will survive, and maybe the show will end with him coming out of his coma or something, with, like, a big beard or something. But, yeah, I mean, basically, it's people named Stussy are pretty much the ones that are getting mostly killed on the show, it seems. Okay, so, yeah, I would say that's a finale I am super looking forward to, especially now that... the rumblings and things that are being said in the press and at, you know, different convention, whatever they heck the kind of things they are, it's starting to sound like this. They might not ever do any more Fargo after this season. That might be it.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, and this part of me that almost wishes they'd ended just after two seasons. But the way if they pull off a really good finale, I'll feel better about the third season. Even if it's not as good as the first two, at least it was a good
right.
season overall. Just not as good as the first two, but I kind of want them to do a fourth season. I really hope that doesn't, you know, and maybe just do something that maybe it can either be an entirely new characters or maybe do something that brings back or ties other things together. I don't know, but
maybe, you know, they can take a year off, make a kick-ass season of Legion, and then just, like, you know, don't come back until they have time to, like, think of, like, a really good idea. You know, just. Yeah, just don't force it. Just let it happen.
Right. I'm okay with waiting, you know, an addition. I'll wait like a year and a half or whatever it takes if it means I'm going to get a really great season. And that way both Legion and Fargo can stand on their own. Because, you know, we continue to suspect Legion kind of sapped the Fargo energy a little bit for the first half of the season. It's very interesting how the show suddenly got much better and more towards the second half of the season. It's like, I wonder if that's about when he was really pretty much all done with Legion, got that out of his system, and was like, oh, now I can direct my time, more of my focus on this show. Although, we do love the third episode, but, you know, it's a quirky one. Okay, so let's wrap it up here, because, as we said, we're not doing Twin Peaks this week. But hopefully the two shows we covered were enough for you guys. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you should certainly enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page. So look us up on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul, Fargo, Twin Peaks, and so on. You can also find us on iTunes. Type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast, and you can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And finally, you can also follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast, at STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. And that is it for this week. Hopefully we will get this out to you when we can. It was great spending the morning with you, Dan, although I think I might go take a nap now.
And I'm heading off to work. So, yeah, we'll be back soon to talk about Dougie and other Twin Peaks related stuff and see what we have going on for the next week and the season finales or maybe series finales of Better Call Saul and Fargo.
That's right. We still have the question about Better Call Saul. Maybe that should be the title of the podcast. Series or season finales? You be the judge. I don't know. All rise. Anyway, on that, good. Oh, it's still morning. I can't say good night. I guess I'll say good morning.
Good morning, y'all.